Hello and welcome along to Cronscast, the fantasy science fiction and horror podcast. I'm Dan Jones.
And I'm Christopher Bean. Today we're discussing a modern science fiction horror masterpiece, the 2013 Jonathan Glazer movie Under the Skin. It stars Scarlett Johansson as a mysterious visitor to Earth who inhabits the body of a beautiful young woman who then drives around Glasgow in a ratty old white van looking for young men to seduce and prey upon. Flipping the idea of predatory sexuality on its head, we follow Johansson as she stalks, talks, and, using her beauty, seduces a series of young men before leading them to a grisly end. Using audacious filmmaking techniques on a limited budget with minimal dialogue and featuring a tour de force performance from Johansson, Glazer creates a disturbing vision of predation and vulnerability that's anything but skin deep. The movie flopped upon release, but quickly won a reputation for being one of the greatest modern arthouse science fiction films.
And we're joined today by horror movie making legends, producer Greg Hale and director Eduardo Sanchez. Greg and Ed exploded onto the movie scene with their debut film, The End of the Millennium found footage horror, The Blair Witch Project, in 1999. Blair Witch was shot on a micro budget and used a combination of bootstrapped production techniques, an unknown cast, and a genius marketing campaign that exploited the early days of the internet to hoodwink a generation. Blair Witch spawned several sequels and spin-offs and remains not only one of the most innovative horror movies of all time, but it generated one of the highest returns on investment of any movie ever made, having been shot for around $500,000, I think, and generating $250 million worldwide. Greg and Ed have worked on numerous other movies and TV shows over the years, including Lovely Molly, VHS, VHS2, Star Trek, Strange New Worlds, Yellow Jackets, American Horror Story, and more. This year, they're venturing into the world of audio drama with the release of their podcast series, Black Velvet Fairies, which is part of their Emerald Anvil world, which features drama, board games, NFTs, and even a novel. So, welcome, Greg and Ed. Well, actually, that's a bit of a misnomer because we don't actually have Ed online just yet. He'll join us very soon. So, how are you, Greg?
I'm good, guys. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
No, thanks for joining us. We're really looking forward to this. So yeah, Under the Skin.
Yeah,
it's a bit under the radar. So and it's a bit of an eclectic choice. So tell us why you decided to talk about Under the Skin.
Well, I mean, I definitely know that you guys are super serious about your sci-fi, fantasy, and horror. So I knew that I couldn't go with something obvious. So tried to give you guys some, you know, more interesting choices. I always loved Under the Skin. I think it's really one of the great science fiction horror films ever made. And it just seemed like a good, like, deep project that we could dig into together. Because I know you guys are going to have great insights and stories about it, too.
There's a lot going on with Under the Skin, that's for sure. Yeah. I mean, when did you see it when it first came out? Because it really was a bit of a sleeper.
I saw it when it was theatrically released. I actually saw it twice in the theater, I think. And I'm pretty sure that the first time I saw it, I did not, because I typically try to avoid getting too much information about a movie before I see it. And there wasn't a lot of information about that movie out anyway. So I'm pretty sure when I first saw it, I had not been given the pitch that Scarlett Johansson is an alien hunting men. So I was kind of figuring it out or trying to figure it out as you went along, which was kind of an amazing way of seeing it. And then having a completely different experience the second time I saw it in the theater, you know, knowing in advance, like what was happening.
I wonder if it didn't do very well at the cinema, and I didn't see it when it came out at the cinema. I saw it a little bit after that, and I've rewatched it since to swat up for this recording. But I wonder if it, I mean, there's a few reasons probably why it didn't do so well. And I wonder if one of the reasons is that the plot line sounds quite similar to Species, you know, the sort of crappy science fiction. I want to do in quote marks, erotic science fiction thriller, right, from the mid 90s.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing about it, you know, when you hear it pitched, you know, she's an alien, you know, I guess, you know, disguised as a human hunting men. It does. It kind of sounds like a B movie science fiction plot, and it definitely, you know, could be, but it's obviously, you know, not that at all. I don't know. I definitely boned up on my Under the Skin. I watched it a couple of times in the last week, and I read a bunch of stuff about it before the podcast today. I guess it premiered at Venice or one of the big festivals, and got like half the audience booed it. Like, it got actively booed at its premiere, which is, to me, somebody who really loves it, is kind of shocking. But then you start thinking about it, it's like, okay, I kind of see, like, if you don't go in for the ride, like, right at the beginning, that the movie would be really boring.
Well, right? it's certainly challenging, let's say that.
Yeah.
And it's and Jonathan Glazer, the director, he was probably best known for Sexy Beast. Have you seen Sexy Beast?
Yep, I saw that when it came out. Saw Bird.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
and that's how that came off the end of a few years of British gangster movies, and the dialogue in that was like Machine Gun, you know, Ben Kingsley doing Don Logan, rat-a-tat-a-tat-a-tat, no, and that was like maximal dialogue, and then he goes to this, which is minimal dialogue, and so it's definitely a volte-face from Glazer. So it probably did pull the rug out from a few people. But it is a great film. It is a great film. If you take it on its own terms and you try to unpick exactly what's going on. Did you read the original novel by Michael Faber?
I did not. I did look up a little bit about that. I guess it's like very, very different from...
Well, I think it's supposed to be... I've not read it either. I think from what I gather, it's a bit more on the nose.
Yes,
and,
right.
And the Johansson character, the woman, it's explicitly mentioned that she's working for an intergalactic food corporation or something.
Right.
And it
just
reminded me of Peter Jackson's Bad Taste. And I thought, I'd rather have bad taste, you know. And I actually prefer the ambiguity of Glazer's film.
I have not read the novel, although apparently it's really good, right? Awards.
Faber writes beautifully. There's no doubt about that.
And I guess Glazer was working on the film for like 10 years.
Yeah.
At some point, Brad Pitt was attached to be the alien. It was going to be a husband and wife alien team.
Though it was the one that went into production. In terms of the screenplay, was the third one, because the first two screenplays were almost the book. Jonathan Glazer was saying when he was making it that, interview when he was making it, that the method of shooting it informed the actual outcome of how it looked and how it became less, you know, more minimal and less glitzy, I suppose, which is what those people who didn't like it were expecting when they went to the cinema and they just see the word alien and they're expecting spaceships, they're expecting all that kind of stuff so often.
When you see Scarlett Johansson's name attached to it, you certainly get an expectation of something.
Yeah.
And she plays to type in a respect in the fact that she's in as far as she's playing a beautiful woman. And it's explicitly intentional that she is beautiful. That is the point of this movie.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she's playing against type as well. And it's, I guess, you know, from a filmmaker's perspective, I'd like to talk about some of the techniques that Glazer used, and also the use of somebody like Johansson, who's a bona fide A-list star and also one of the most glamorous and beautiful actresses in the world.
Yeah.
And when she's, you know, I guess the first question is, from her perspective and from the filmmaker's perspective, is that a risk, using an actress of that stature in a movie like this? And the second question is, about the technique. So again, from your perspective as a filmmaker, one of the things that Glazer did was have Johansson drive around in this ratty old white van around Glasgow, talking to these young men. And these young men were real Glaswegians. They were they're not actors. They didn't even know they were being filmed because Glazer put hidden cameras into the van.
Right.
So they would walk up to Johansson, or she would wind down the window and initiate a conversation, most likely wholly improvised.
Yeah.
And again, there's something really risky that strikes me as really risky anyway. So what's your take on that?
I mean, I love it. I honestly think that's why the movie works. I think that there is something about that kind of naturalistic performance that it's not a performance. I mean, that's kind of the whole point, right? Those men aren't performing. They're not aware that they're performing at all. They're just being themselves, and they're very naturally reacting to Scarlett Johansson, even though they don't recognize who she is. They're reacting to the beauty in exactly the way you would in real life, right? The nervousness.
It's really, and the exactly, the nervousness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then the bravado, like the way she, you know, lures them into saying certain things or feeling certain things, and you see it in their faces as it's working on them.
It's such really a strange thing. I thought that the alien species, they must have enough knowledge about humans to understand that there's a sexual attraction between male and female. But I think that's really as far as it goes. I don't think the aliens had to understand the concept of beauty until the Johansson character, the woman, sees herself in the mirror a little bit later on, because she treats all of the men exactly the same way. She talks to them, she compliments them, she says, right, you have a nice smile, nice eyes. And right, and the women and the men are just, like you said, you'd think that the men are always not the aggressor, but the on the front foot when it comes to sexual interactions. But these men are very nervous when it comes.
The
first one, she winds down the window and she says, excuse me, can you tell me the way to the A8, the M8, whatever it is? And the lad, and he's only about 18, he looks at the looks in the window, and you can see it for about half a second. He's petrified because it's this beautiful woman who's looking at him.
The first guy who does it, the guy that doesn't get in the car, the guy that doesn't get in the van. They all have, there's all like a little, you know, fear or surprise or something in that interaction that, you know, that just makes it feel so real. And I think you couple that with all the, you know, apparently they just drove around for hours and hours and hours and hours shooting, not only the hidden camera stuff inside the van, but shooting outside to catch all the people on the street. And I forget how many hours they had, hundreds of hours of footage that they had to sort through. But it was that documentary. It's a little Blair Witchy, right? In a way, right? It's this feeling that it's a documentary in a way that's really, really hard to simulate. So I think the fact that, like, you've got such a surreal premise, right? This alien with this really surrealistic thing that she's doing to the men with the black goo and all this stuff that's like really outlandish visually. Like, what the hell is going on? Coupled with stuff that's like so common and mundane and everyday. I think it's that juxtaposition between those two extremes that really make the movie work, right? And it's watching her, you know, as a character, navigate her way to some sort of like middle ground where she's kind of under, because she has no understanding of what she's seeing out those windows, right, at first. And then the movie really is about her kind of trying to come to an understanding about something that she did not understand at the beginning. I mean, it's a beautiful, in a way, it's a really grotesque movie, but it's also a really beautiful film in a lot of ways. Sad and horrific.
It is sad. Really, the two things that it reminded me of when I was rewatching it was the Margaret Atwood quote about men are afraid that women will laugh at them, and women are afraid that men will kill them. And it's an inversion of that. That's the thing that I thought of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's flipped that completely on its head. The men, they're not afraid of Johansson's woman. They're not afraid of her, but they are. And they do, once they realize, oh, I'm actually in here, they do pursue her. But it leads to a grisly end. But they are wary.
I think there's a deeper point to that in terms of she doesn't become scared of humans or men until the
until she becomes self-conscious.
Yeah, until at the beginning when she's witnessing allowing the baby on the beach and those people, and she's completely oblivious. And it's not until the woodcutter at the end where she feels threatened and in a sexual way.
That's the second thing that the film reminded me of. You mentioned the woodcutter, is Snow White. It follows actually quite, again, when you get under the skin, there's actually a Snow White mechanism going through this film. Because at the beginning, she's doing something pretty grisly to these men, but she's also very beautiful, and she doesn't know that she's beautiful. She goes through the department store and copies the other women because they're putting lipstick on. They're trying on makeup, they're putting on skirts and trousers, they're trying out new fashion. She just copies them because that's what the other women do. She doesn't know. She's just trying to blend in. She doesn't know that it's to accentuate beauty or to stand out. Later on, when she sees the mirror, she begins to understand. And when she has the sexual encounter with the kindly man from the bus, that accentuates her self-consciousness as well. In Snow White, in the original Snow White and the Widow Queen, one of the things that the evil queen does before sending her into the woods is give her gifts. She gives her a gift of a hairpin, a hairbrush, and a mirror. And you think, well, why would you do that? Why would you give a beautiful young girl a hairpin, a hairbrush, and a mirror? Because they make you self-conscious, which is exactly what happened to her. When she looked in the mirror, she realized she wasn't the most beautiful woman in the land. It was Snow White. So what do? You make them self-conscious. And as soon as Snow White becomes self-conscious, she becomes scared, and she has to run into the woods, and she has to escape. And it's the same thing which happens with Johansson's woman here. She has to run as soon as she becomes self-conscious. I don't know what you think of that. It just occurred to me as I was watching it.
No, totally makes sense. I mean, especially the woodcutter thing, which would not surprise me at all if that was an intentional analogy that he was trying to make. One of many like very subtle things that's happening in that movie, you know, that he's...
Yeah, I mean, originally our expectations for the dynamic between the men and the women, or the woman, is subverted at the beginning, where she is the predator and the men are the unwitting victims. And by the end, because she's become self-conscious, and possibly she's trying to understand her role in what's happening to the humans, she becomes more human. She fulfills the expected, what would you say, gender role in the sexual dynamic. And the woodcutter is the predator.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, I always kind of took it as that she's deciding, and I guess this does track with the novel. I did not know this when I saw it, but it does track with the novel, is that she decides that she doesn't want to do this anymore. Like she feels bad about preying on these humans, right? So she's having like a change of not only self-awareness, but she's having a conscience about what she's doing, and that's what she's kind of trying to get away from by, you know, leaving the van and walking in the rain when she finds the as you said, the kindly guy. But yeah, like once she lets down that role as predator, she kind of becomes part of, like, that Margaret Atwood quote, which is such a sad and true quote, right? She enters that realm, right? Well, now she is kind of setting herself, because she's not like physically any more capable of doing anything. It doesn't seem like, you know, not any more physically capable of doing anything to thwart what this guy wants to do.
Yeah, she has the same physical strength and capability as a human woman of her size and strength. You know, she's not Black Widow in this film by any stretch, is she?
Like, that her power really is whatever that weird transitional black room thing is. That's where the alien...
Yeah, I mean, what did the black room, just as a bit of context, the black room where she successfully seduces one of the young men, you next see them, it cuts to an entirely black room, and she will undress and beckon the men towards her. Then the men will undress. They keep walking towards her because they're fixated on her. And eventually they become consumed by this black goo. I mean, what do you think's going on there? It's such a strange vignette, image.
Man. And such beautiful. I mean, really, my favorite imagery in the whole movie is all that black room stuff, So at the very beginning, when they find the body of the woman that she takes the clothes from, at the very beginning, that's an all white room. They're in an all white space, and then all the stuff with the men is in an all black space. And I was thinking that was my take, was that the white space is some sort of in between realm, that is a transitional state for the aliens to move into the human world, right? So she's in that state because she's prepared to go from whatever her alien state of being is to being in the human world. And the black space is the opposite. The black space is where the aliens transition a human from an earthly realm or a human realm into whatever alien space that they're in. Because it's obviously, it's not physical travel. Right, it's some sort of state of being or something that they're putting these men in, because they don't even seem aware that they're in this black room, right?
Well, they enter a house.
She leads
them to this rickety old house.
Right, they enter a house, and then they're suddenly in an all black space, and they don't really react to being in this space at all. All they're doing is
all they see is Johansson. That's it. All they see is the woman.
Yeah, yeah. So to me, it's like. That I always kind of thought that's like some sort of like, it's not an entirely physical space. I mean, obviously their physical body, something's happening to their physical bodies, but it's not just a physical space. It's some sort of like in between space between the alien world or realm and the human realm.
It's something she can control and the men can't.
Yeah, because obviously she lets the guy with the cystofibrosis or whatever, the guy that with the facial
tumors. Yeah. Yeah.
He goes into the muck. He goes into the blackness. And then obviously she's able to pull him out and let him go.
Yeah.
She makes that decision that she can get them out if she wants.
But I think that's when we first start to see her, for want of a better phrase, humanity coming. Because up to that point, everybody, the others who have gone in. So when you see the insides of, teleported to another planet, or that blood or whatever it is, feeding the spacecraft, feeding her, wherever it's going, whatever that might be. The skin is left floating like that, really like watery, in that watery way. And he is set free, doesn't go through any of that. And there's an argument there for, again, this sort of toxic masculinity being the downfall for these people.
Right,
chasing them, and he doesn't. He's got a lot more compassion, a lot more humility, and she starts to feel, that kind of.
I took that as where you see two of the men see each other, two of the victims see each other in the black goo.
Yeah.
I read it as, and then you see everything, under the skin.
Yeah,
disappears or is consumed, and all that's left is the skin, like you say. And I read that as being, well, the skin, the surface, is not important to the aliens. That's a waste product or a byproduct. They're not interested in that. They're interested in what's underneath.
Yeah.
So that's what they value. And you see that in that. I think that supports the idea that when Johansson, the woman, is talking to anybody, whether it's, whether that you'd say, well, that guy is quite good looking, or it's the man with the facial tumors, she treats them exactly the same because she's not actually interested. Even though she pays them a compliment,
right.
You have nice hands, you have nice eyes, you have a nice smile. She's not interested in what's on the surface.
Yeah.
Not until she becomes self-conscious of her own looks.
Yeah, yeah.
But she's fulfilling a role, isn't she? That's what her...
She is. It's a job.
The guy on the motorbike... who has to get more guys on the motorbike to come and help him find her because she's gone rogue and she's not doing what she's meant to be doing.
We should talk about the man on the motorbike because this is the one thing I couldn't quite figure out. He's like a handler? He's like a handler or something?
Is he a alien or is he a human? Is he another alien or is he a human that works for the aliens?
I mean, it's interesting they all wear black and white. leather. You know, like you've got, she's wearing a fur coat, they're wearing leather, she's peeling her skin off, this skin, you know, like there's a lot of coded stuff there to unpick or to hint at. And for me, because I've never seen it before, I was watching it, I thought I'd seen it before, but I was thinking about another film.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was thinking about Under the Shadow, which is set in the 80s in the Iran war, where a woman is trapped in her apartment with a djinn and shaving her baby. It's another dark, gritty, you know, award-winning horror, sci-fi, whatever. But that's what I thought it was. So I started watching it. When he came on first, I was thinking, is he a familiar, in like a witch's familiar? But as it goes on, I think you get the sense that, like Dan says, there's an element of him being a handler or some kind of bureaucrat, because then a whole cadre of them come at the end when she goes rogue and they're trying to find her.
Yeah. And there's a scene where she is standing in the black space, just perfectly upright, inert, just looking blankly ahead. And he's walking around her, inspecting her, you know, the way that you would inspect a horse. Yeah. He's looking in her eyes.
They're not in the black space in that.
Oh, where was that? I
was trying to really watch that scene. They're on some sort of surface. She's on like a cobblestone street or something. He's not in the black space with her. It's a physical space that he's with her in.
Well, that's right. The street that goes with the man on the bus, which incidentally IMDb have as Bud Driver rather than Bus Driver, Man on Bud. That is a cobbled street. And I think it happens at that time, doesn't it? When that's after she's leapt from the bed and...
She doesn't have any interaction with them after that, because she's escaped.
She's run. Yeah, she's on the run, isn't she?
It's before.
I think it's before she meets the man with the facial tumors.
Yeah. But it's like they do it. I always kind of took it as like they've done a couple of runs, and now he's going to check in on her, and he's going to make sure that everything's like working okay.
Well, there's a knock on the door. Who's that?
Oh my God.
It's hello. Ed Sanchez, welcome. Director of the Blair Witch Project.
Hello. Ed. Sorry I'm late. We were clearing brush from an island like 10 minutes ago. And I ran in and cleaned up. No, I have some land in West Virginia. And we were clearing brush from an island, so.
And you stopped clearing brush to come and talk to us.
Yeah, you guys are special. See, you guys are real special.
That's a compliment. Yeah. So how are you doing, Ed? Apart from, you know, all your brush clearing activities.
I'm doing good. I mean, you know, the business is slow. I wish I had more jobs, but you know, everything's good. Everything's pretty good.
We're going to talk about that a little bit later on, aren't we? About the state of play. In the film industry. We're talking about Under the Skin, you know.
Oh my God.
Yeah. What's your take on it? Because there's a lot of coded stuff going on in that movie and we're trying to unpick it.
Yeah, we've had a big row.
Really? I mean, I just watched it
Greg's
again.
Greg has been tipping off all over the place.
Really? I mean...
No, absolutely.
Like you mean beyond like... this is like an alien, and I started thinking about it. It's like, it's almost like she's on a field trip, you know, she's like an adolescent or she's a toddler, and those guys are basically babysitters, and they're just letting these things loose to experience humanity or whatever. But, you know, that's where I kind of landed, at least today, coming, driving to West Virginia, just thinking about it. What do you guys, how deep did you guys get?
We were actually just talking about the motorcycle guys just now, like what their role was. Are they handlers? Are they familiars? Are they masters? Are they servants? We were just talking about the motorcycle guys.
I think that like, And you, do you guys think that those guys were also like not human?
Yeah, I do. I think
we don't know.
It seems that way, right?
Yeah, I think it's strongly hinted.
Yeah,
it's hinted that they're alien. But the thing is that the film is explicit about Johansson's woman being an alien. It doesn't leave it ambiguous. It's very explicit. You see what she really is underneath or under the skin, literally.
Right. Yeah.
So, but with the men, with the hand, the motorcyclist, let's say the motorcyclist, it's ambiguous. And you're left at the end. The final shot is of the motorcyclist standing on a mountain in the Cairngorms, probably staring out at the landscape in human form. And that's it. There's no explanation given to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he's pissed off because he's going to get his wrist slapped.
Yeah, well, I mean, I get he's pissed off because he lost her. You know, he lost her or he lost it or whatever. But I think that, I mean, it's almost like, again, and the reason that I kind of went towards like, you know, like a toddler, like, because, you know, she's very, you know, she's kind of experiencing things. And even though she's, you know, bringing these dudes back to be, you know, consumed in that liquid or whatever, which is trippy as shit. It seems like the handler, like, remember that scene when he's like looking at her, like, it seems like the handler's definitely older, like an adult. And he's just like, you know, and he's just cleaning up after her. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah,
we
said he's like inspecting her, right? He's like inspecting her, making sure. I read it as like he was checking that she was physically okay to do the job that she's supposed to do.
Yeah.
So checking her out, making sure she her eyes and she and he again had no reaction to the fact that she's beautiful. He was just checking her out, not checking her out in that way, but checking, you know, like the way you check a car, you know, you kick the tires and you check the oil. I didn't get that.
I think it was a psychological check. To check that she's on task, not to see that she looks the part. Why did you?
Yeah, it's almost like he was really staring at her eye, like there's something about the eye that shows him whether she's again like you were saying. I guess is she all right or not? Like I think she's just checking on him. Like, am I going to have to pull the plug or get another skin or what? You know. And then the scene, and then it was interesting too, because like, you know, where that scene where she comes down the steps and stares into the mirror, he does the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like later on, you know what I'm saying? Like he kind of just looks in the mirror for a little beat, he's also like checking himself out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, look, I ultimately land on the side of he's an alien. For a bunch of reasons, not the least of which is he definitely seems to have some sort of ability to track her, because he goes to where that guy is coming out, the guy with the facial deformity. He goes right to the house where that guy is coming from. So he's like, I always kind of thought he's like honing in on some sort of residual signal that she has on him, but he's lost her signal. Right, he's not picking up her signal anymore, but he can find that guy for some reason, which makes me think that he's got some sort of, you know, extrasensory perception or something that humans don't have.
But Bean mentioned a little bit earlier something about toxic masculinity, and I'm the resident sort of defender of the patriarchy, or at least the mainly because I'm the one that's mainly qualified for it because I've got the kids. But it's don't laugh. It's not funny.
You missed something.
Oh, did I? Oh, right. Well, it's probably best that I missed that. I probably can guess. the guy you were saying, I'm trying to work this out. He follows her up and he has some sort of means of tracking everything. So some sort of surveillance capability. It's interesting. The if the masculine part of his personality is completely unfettered and left to evolve to its conclusion, then that becomes unbridled tyranny. So that's the masculine pathology, tyranny, an imposition of holistic order over everything, surveillance, tracking, control. Whereas the unbridled feminine is consumption and chaos. It's the opposite. And so you need, obviously, mythologically, you need a mixture of both in order to create a happy medium so that the world, the future can be unfolded, but not too much. It can be ordered at the same time. You can make sense of it, but not too much sense because you need to evolve. You need to have a little bit of chaos. And maybe that's, I don't know, maybe that's what the black goo is. It's like this chaos state, this unfettered feminism that the men just become, they literally sink into it because they have no control over themselves. They have no control over the situation. But the motorcyclist, if he has that surveillance capability, then maybe he is like the unfettered conclusion of the masculine temperament in this sort of weird alien context. And Johansson's woman, at least before she goes rogue, is the feminine equivalent of that because she's completely chaotic. She acts in a way that these young men, who, when we've said their reactions are genuine, she acts in a way that these young men don't expect, and it makes them quite nervous. And eventually she literally sucks them into this realm of this weird realm of chaos.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I know that the novel, which I, again, have not read, but, read the Wikipedia, is that it's pretty explicit that she's gathering them for food. She works for a food corporation. She's gathering them for food. I think it's kind of implied that maybe the physical form has something to do with it. Like Bean was talking about, like the little meat chute that appears after the one guy gets, you know, the meat gets sucked out of his skin.
Yeah.
But I always thought that she's actually doing something a lot deeper or more primal or something than actually eating, that they're not just getting the meat, because it doesn't make any sense. Like practically, it would be so much easier for them to harvest humans a ton of different ways of harvesting humans. That would be a lot more efficient than sending some sort of spy down to lure them into a black goo and do all this shit, right? Just drop down in some isolated village and take them 200 at a time, and then nobody ever knows that, you know, you've taken those 200. That seems a lot more efficient if they're just for food. So I always kind of thought that the emotional thing was kind of part of it. Like Ed was saying, like she's some sort of, there's something experiential at stake for the aliens, right? That there's some sort of mission that has to do with understanding the emotion or the soul of somebody, right? That's what I always took the goo as being, not so much a physical thing as a metaphysical thing, that something metaphysical is happening to these men, and they're harvesting something like their soul more than they're harvesting, you know, 150 pounds of meat and bone, which doesn't, you know, make a lot of sense.
It is interesting when you see the two men in the goo, and they realize they see each other, they notice each other, and they have a little intimate moment, don't they, where one of them touches the other one's hand, you know, almost like a gesture of comfort.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. Until the one guy realizes how gooey the other guy is.
the guy's skin is like, he's like falling apart. Look, it's
camera.
The what?
Those are all in camera sequences. That's really all just filmed. I mean, I'm sure they're enhancing some stuff here and there with CG, but all that stuff is a physical makeup job in a water tank.
Oh, okay.
It's really cool.
That's really cool.
You look at the video of all, everything is physical. The goo is a 100% physical effect. And how they figured out how to do it, I won't get into it because it would take a long time. You should look it up. Like the making of, like the behind the scenes, almost everything is in camera, and it's really amazing. It's really amazing.
Sorry, go on.
Well, because there's a, like the thing about the goo, you know, I was like, it's kind of amazing that it's practical because like there's no waves or anything.
Yeah.
So it has, it's viscous enough to not like, you know, there's no, it doesn't act like even like oil, you know what I'm saying? And also there's that one shot where the dude literally like keeps his eyes on her. I mean, all of them do, but they have a shot where he just goes in and you see the goo all the way into his eyes and he doesn't blink. I was like, that's, again, that's why I thought that's, you know, maybe that's, you know, some kind of CG or something because like, it just, I mean, it looks real as hell.
Yeah,
but it's just how'd they pull that off?
You got to watch. I mean,
the film only had a budget of what, $6 million. So it wasn't
really.
It's quite low budget.
It's an A24 movie, so it's not much money.
An early A24. They got a little more cash now, but back then they didn't. Wow, I had no idea it was that cheap. Really?
So I guess, you know, they spent some money on filming on location. They had to pay Scarlett. They had to hire a van. And I guess the rest of the money went on that shot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, other than the goo, it's a pretty cheap movie, you know?
True. The goo and the practical makeup effects in the water tank. Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's pretty simple. Yeah.
You got to build the goo room.
The goo room. She probably did it for scale. She probably didn't. I bet she didn't demand a fee. I think
by all accounts, she was very attached to it, and she stuck with it even when it was sort of caught in development hell. She stuck with it for 3 or 4 years.
As far
as I can tell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. We probably better wrap up the first half of our recording. I just wanted to ask, actually. How did you, there's a couple of Americans, how did you get on with the Glaswegian accents?
Because I wanted to know Glaswegian accents.
There's definitely multiple lines in that movie where I have no idea what they're saying.
Yeah, I had the subtitles.
Yeah, no, it's the same thing. I was not, but also like the stuff that, like the, because she only talks to those guys, like, so there's not really that much like important information. So I was just kind of like, because sometimes are great, but they do distract you from the visuals, you know, and it's such a visual film, you know? And, so I wanted to avoid the subtitles and I was just like, you know, it's not like there's plot points being given in, you know, with their talk. So I was just like, let me just, and, you know, again, like Greg said, you know, every other sentence, I had no idea what the hell we were saying, but.
I wondered if Glasgow was chosen precisely because of that especially for an international audience, give it that sense of that further sense of alienation and difference.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. I'm sort of reaching possibly with that.
I could see that. I mean, look, dude, he clearly, that guy thinks about everything.
Yeah. Definitely.
There's nothing accidental happens in his movies unless he wants it to be accidental, like with the improv stuff with the guys, right? But everything in that guy's movies, I mean, you watch Zone of Interest and it's like, it's all so meticulously thought through.
Did you watch Zone of Interest? Have you seen it yet?
Yeah, I've seen it twice.
Yeah, I love that.
And I've never wanted to leave a movie that was amazing more than that movie. I thought it was just horrifying, but amazing.
Hmm. Well, we'll call it on that note. So thanks very much, Greg and Ed. We'll see you next time when we're going to be talking about Black Velvet Fairies, Blair Witch, and other such horrors. So see you soon.
Hello and welcome to Mars Radio 14, the third best radio station in the Martian Space Force broadcasting spectrum. My name is Captain Half Milk Carton, and today we're going to be looking at the planet Earth and the forest of Shan Laba Feistein in particular to investigate a phenomenon known to humans as ghosts. And to do this, we've sent our traveling reporter, Lieutenant Bungalow, to go and to take a look. Can you hear me, Bungalow?
Yeah, I can hear you. And why am I here again? This place smells like Antabi and Glabines. It's pitch dark.
Were you not listening to the intro, Bungalow?
Sort of. I mean, to be honest, I kind of tune you out most of the time. No offense, it's just... you're a jackass.
I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that. Anyway, you are in the forest of Shan Laba 15 on planet Earth to investigate a phenomenon known to humans as ghosts, Bungalow.
We did that already.
No, we didn't, Bungalow.
Yes, we did. It was the Mythago Wood episode of SFF Cronscast. I mean, would John frickin' Gerald have milk carton? Hello?
That one was about phantoms, which are a totally different phenomenon. And my name is Captain Hat Milk Carton to you. Get it right, Lieutenant. My title was hard earned.
Ah, whatever you say. Anyways, I thought that episode was about, ooh, ghosts, your worshipfulness.
It wasn't about ghosts. Nobody mentioned ghosts. It was about phantoms.
Well, I thought it was ghosts. I may have been hallucinating on, mushrooms.
For obligon's sake, you went to Earth to investigate the phenomenon known to humans as ghosts.
No, I thought you said it was phantoms, so it wasn't just me tripping on mushrooms. Ha! Anyway, well, I'm back again, doing the same thing, again.
Right! Or no, wrong! Just to be clear, I was right.
Fine. You were right, Captain.
And?
And what?
And what do you see in Shan Laba 13? Are there any ghosts? This is radio. The listeners can't see what you are seeing.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I can see trees. I mean, it's pretty dark, but, there's a few specters about the place. But to be honest, I'm having a bit of trouble talking to them. Every time I go up and say hello, they just take off running.
Well, run after them then.
Believe me, I've tried. I mean, ghosts are fast. I wouldn't mind, but they're wearing anoraks and carrying camcorders, which you'd think would slow them down. But I still couldn't catch them. I'm in prime physical condition. Here, give me a minute and I'll try again. I just want to adjust my interior vestibule so that the chest plumage can sprout out underneath its tendrils. I mean, in case they start filming, you know, I need to look good.
What do you mean?
You know, so that they know the Martian Space Force is always well turned out.
Hang on, Bungalow. Is that the truth? Because it sounds to me like you want to impress these ghosts so you can go and be in their film. Tell the truth, you've never really liked me, or Mars Radio 14. You'd rather help a group of ghosts make a film in a forest on planet Earth than serve the needs of the listeners to the third best radio station in the Martian Space Force. I knew it.
No, it's not like that at all. Well, I mean, okay, maybe a little.
Maybe a lot. Well, I tell you what, you do just that. Go off and make films with your phantom friends in the forest of Shan Laba 15.
They're not phantoms, they're ooh, ghosts. I mean, you said so yourself.
Well, go off then and make films with ghosts.
Well, I'd love to, but they keep running away from me.
I don't blame them. For obviously God's sake. We leave it there, folks.
This episode of Cronscast was brought to you by Dan Jones and Christopher Bean, with our special guests Greg Hale and Eduardo Sanchez. Additional content was provided by Brian Sexton and Jay Starlipper. Thanks to Brian Turner and all the staff at Krons, and thanks to you for listening. Join us next time when we'll continue our conversation with Greg and Ed. The filmmaking duo talked to us about their forthcoming project Emerald Anvil, their audio drama Black Velvet Fairies, and plans for the 25th anniversary of the Blair Witch Project. See you then!